history about ideas,
some of which really started out as my attempt to respond to Jim Buchanan's review of my first book, Machinery of Freedom, where he pointed out a gaping hole in the logic of my argument that I had not been aware of, and I've been trying to fill it ever since. Back when I wrote Machinery, there were a couple of points that I tried to make. One of them was an argument for why a system of private competing law enforcement systems would generate something close to efficient law. And another question was whether or not such a system would be stable. In particular, I was concerned with the risk that a cartel of private law enforcement agencies would conclude that robbery was more profitable than production and turn themselves back into a government. And my conclusion was that how likely that was would depend largely on the economies of scale in the rights enforcement industry. And if it turned out the economies of scale went way up, you have a small number of firms and a cartel agreement would be practical, whereas if you had lots of small firms, it wouldn't be. And the point that Jim made in his review was that I had thought about allocational but not distributional equilibrium of my market. That the way I described it was I imagined two rights enforcement agencies bargaining over the legal rules of the court that they're going to use. And my argument was that if a change in legal rules produced net benefits for the customers of the agencies, then the agencies would find it in their interest to agree to that change, possibly with side payments. And the point Jim made was, suppose my agency is bargaining with yours and my customers are pro-capital punishment and yours are anti-capital punishment. Does that mean that I've got my does my agency have to pay yours to agree to capital punishment, or does yours have to pay mine to agree to no capital punishment? That I hadn't really thought of the fact that you really need a baseline. You need some starting point to bargain from. And although I had thought about the allocational problem of why you get efficient rules, I haven't thought about the distributional problem of how, in getting those efficient rules, who pays whom. And so I've been thinking about that question ever since. And it seems to me that the right way of looking at it is that underlying the game I had described, and I would suspect underlying all social institutions, is a mutual threat game. That in effect, the agencies are all bargaining with each other on the basis of, if we can't reach an agreement, we'll be fighting each other. And that to some degree, the equilibrium of that game, which, like things I was discussing yesterday, is really a bilateral monopoly kind of game. They're both better off with an agreement, but they disagree about whether the agreement should require us paying you or you paying us, that the equilibrium of that game, once reached, is going to give you the sort of status quo starting point you'll bargain from. And I don't really have a very good theory of the equilibrium of bilateral monopoly games, nor as far as I know it's anybody else. But we do observe an awful lot of such games in the real world. If you think about union management bargaining, about negotiations between countries over things like where the border is going to be when there's a dispute, all of those are similar kind of bilateral monopoly games. And we observe that most countries most of the time are at peace, most firms most of the time do not have a strike on them, and that therefore it looks as though somehow you get an equilibrium in these bilateral monopoly bargaining games, which partly depends on the ability of each side to impose costs on the other. Sort of power and vulnerability kinds of things are going to determine how believable my threat to fight if you won't agree to my terms is. And it seemed to me that if you think about it in those terms, then you're going to start out, as it were, with this mutual threat game. Once that's settled, then the players from there can bargain to an efficient outcome. And that it looks to me as though once you've got an initial equilibrium of a mutual threat game, they tend to be pretty stable. You don't observe that national boundaries move half a mile every time one country gets a better army or builds a new battleship or something. And that therefore, the initial equilibrium we built on some kind of an initial mutual threat game, but once it was there, it would be most of the dead hand of the past. But mostly it would just, everybody knows that if you want to change what we've now got, you've got to pay us rather than us paying you. So that was sort of as far as I got, but then it occurred to me that that had an interesting and perhaps unfortunate implication for the other half of my argument, namely the question of whether the system was stable. Because even if there are no economies of scale, in the provision of rights protection, and I don't know, it's obviously in some economy of scale, but even if, as I argued in Machinery of Freedom, and I still think it's pretty plausible, economies of scale and rights enforcement don't go very high, far up. But, you know, a town police department seems to work at least as efficiently as a big city or state police or whatever. Even if you don't get economies of scale from that side, the private enforcement agencies are really producing two products. One of them is rights enforcement for their customers, but the other is the ability to make threats against their competitors, against the other agencies, in order to do well in this initial mutual threat game. And certainly it looks, in terms of history, as though very often there are economies of scale in the use of military force, which is in a sense what this is about, going up quite large. Now, that depends. Different technologies have different economies of scale. It's not like we've always had a one-world empire. We've never had a one-world empire. But there certainly have been many times when it looked as though big countries could push small countries around if they wanted to. So that's disturbing because that suggests that there's going to be a source of economies of scale which might drive you to large rights enforcement agencies even if there was no reason in terms of the real product they're producing. So that was sort of what the sense in which answering Jim's question got me into thinking about another and interesting issue. Now, let me go back to my point about inertia, about the stability of the equilibria, because that suggests that if you can once do it, if you can once somehow establish a set of accepted agreements among the agencies, then the ability to threaten other agencies is going to become less and less important in their ordinary functioning because everybody will know that if you insist on renegotiating at the point of a gun, you're a bad guy, and probably the other agencies should help out your the one you're targeting because they don't want to happen to them. You can think of a lot of reasons why once this is agreed to, you would expect it to be reasonably stable. If it's reasonably stable, then we can spend most of our money on protecting our customers and only a little bit on the extra couple of tanks we've got in the backyard. And so that would then get us back to the kind of economy of scale I want. So it seemed to me that answering Jim's question did actually result in somewhat improving my understanding of the logic of what I've been talking about. One further point that I ought to make, and this is actually related to a talk I'll be giving in a week or so on possible PhD thesis topics, is that we actually have, I would claim, a real-world experiment available to give us an answer to these questions. Because if you think about the strategic situation of car insurance companies, you will realize that logically the structure of the game they are playing with each other is the same as the structure of the game that my rights enforcement agencies are playing. My rights enforcement agencies have a set of conflicts between each other, and for each conflict they've got two alternatives, warfare or arbitration, essentially, where the arbitration will be prearranged, of course. Warfare is more expensive. On the other hand, if you expect the arbitration to go against your customer, you might say, well, you know, we'd like to be able to serve our customers. Automobile insurance companies, every time that there is an accident where the people involved in the accident have different insurance companies, are facing two alternatives. Litigation, which is expensive, that's the equivalent of warfare, or arbitration, which is what they almost always do, in which, as I understand it, and I haven't investigated this at much length, and so it occurred to me it was an interest that was relevant to mine, but as far as I can tell, almost all of the intra-insurance company conflicts are handled without going to the court, because the insurance companies themselves have worked out a set of rules of thumb, which are much less expensive than the court process for deciding, was it my customer at fault or your customer, do we pay or do you? So as far as I can tell, the basic logic of that game is the same as the basic logic of my private rights enforcement agency's game, and I am proposing as a free thesis topic to anybody looking for a thesis topic, investigating that industry and how it works and when the bargaining does or doesn't break down and ideally the history of how those rules were established and so forth, because I'd like to know about it. If I can get somebody else to do my work, I believe that, you know, students and colleagues exist to be exploited. That's why human beings are social animals instead of solitary animals. We live by mutual exploitation, and so I throw out ideas for things I want people to do that I don't feel like doing the work of doing myself. For one thing, I'm basically a theorist because I'm lazy, and therefore I try to get other people to do empirical work most of the time. I guess I'm allowed to speak for another 6 minutes or so. If I understand this, we are working under my greatly preferred Chicago rules for a workshop where any of you who have not read the paper are supposed to pretend you've read the paper and feel very ashamed of yourselves and so forth. It may have occurred to you that there's a real equilibrium problem in maintaining Chicago rules, because if I don't think you've read the paper, I'm going to have to spend 45 minutes giving you the content of the paper, and if I'm going to spend 45 minutes giving you the content of the paper, there's no point in your reading the paper. So I've threatened to provide Mitch Polinsky at Stanford with an alarm clock glued down so that it always rings at 20 minutes after the start of the law and econ workshop, but I haven't actually done so yet. So anyway, let me just have a few more minutes. Let me make a different point, which I also really hadn't thought through at the time that I, a couple of points at the time that I wrote Machinery of Freedom. One of them is that the market I'm looking at is not really a competitive market, even though it looks as though it is. Because the underlying market in my system is the market for legal assent. I am trying to arrange things so that between every pair of people, there's an agreed legal rule to affect conflicts. And of course, I'm doing it with firms, not person by person, but logically you can think of it, you know, the sort of the equivalent of the Robinson Crusoe beginning of an economics textbook. You can think of it of imagining that everybody in the world is bargaining with everybody else in the world to get agreement. The rules don't have to be the same rules with each pair of people, of course. And you then realize that that isn't a competitive market, because it doesn't do any good for me to buy 2 assents from Karen if I don't have one from Peter. She can't provide me a cent for him. So what it really is what does it work out to be? I guess about 10 to the 24 fourth bilateral monopoly bargainings, every pair of people, a little bit more than that, maybe 10 to the 26, I guess, but allow for what was it, 8 billion or close to 8 billion people now. So it's a very, very large number of bilateral monopoly bargains, and you're really falling back on your argument for efficiency to something more like Coase and Marshall, the idea that people are going to try to bargain to efficient rule, and of course they're going to do it with middlemen to make it a little easier. The other point that I haven't thought about adequately, as far as I can remember when I originally wrote the book, is the existence of market failure on this market. And the clear place where you would get market failure is where the agreement between me and Karen affects Peter, who is not a customer of the agency of either of ours. And the simplest example of that is intellectual property law. That when I persuade her, when I try to persuade her, or her agency, her rights enforcement agency, to respect my copyrights, her agreement to do that provides a transfer. She'll pay me some licensing fees for using my intellectual property. It provides a deadweight burden because the marginal cost to me of her using that property is zero, and yet she now has a charge for it. But it also produces a benefit because I now have an incentive to write more books or songs if I could sing, to write fewer songs, I suppose, if I want to benefit the world, and so forth and so on. But the problem is that the benefit of my additional production goes to him, whose agency has not agreed to respect my property rights, intellectual rights, just as to hers, and our agencies will ignore that benefit in their calculation, and therefore the level of intellectual property protection they come up with will be suboptimal. Now, of course, it's possible the optimal level is zero. This is something you'll disagree about, in which case suboptimal is still zero. I don't think I can think of any negative forms of intellectual property protection, but maybe you can. But in principle, at least, this suggests that that's a place where you'll have a predictable suboptimal result due to an ordinary market failure analysis. And there are going to be other such examples. The pollution is the other obvious example of that, that when we bargain over whether each of us will be restrained and how much unpleasant stuff we can put in the atmosphere, again, if Peter is a customer of another agency, he benefits by our keeping down our pollution, but that benefit isn't included in our calculation. Now, obviously, you can have negotiations with more than two rights enforcement agencies, but I want a system with lots of rights enforcement agencies because that's more stable against cartels, and the more agencies there are, the more serious the transaction problems are. They're going to block the complete agreement of everybody to take account of all costs. So that struck me as an interesting case where the system was sort of suboptimal. Another sort of case which really corresponds to my earlier point about it being a lot of bilateral monopolies is that when my agency is deciding how much to offer for capital punishment, they only care about the value of capital punishment to their marginal customers. It just as in any other, if you think of, you know, the efficiency or inefficiency of monopolistic competition firm decisions, that Apple doesn't have to worry about me when they're designing their machines, because even if the machine was 5% worse, I'd still stick with Apple. I'm a committed customer, they have to worry about those people who are so foolish as to be just on the margin between Apple and PC machines, because those are the ones they have to keep. So that's going to be another place where you'll get a less than perfectly efficient. On the other hand, of course, the bottom line of all of this is that any efficiency arguments we have for the workings of government are much, much weaker than the ones I think I'm presenting for this system. So I'm still willing to claim that I have much more reason to believe that my system of private rights enforcers, we have more reason to expect it to generate efficient legal rules than we do for the existing kinds of systems. So that's my 15-minute introduction, and now all of you get to tear it apart.
Okay, Karen?
Yeah, I just need a little clarification of how your system works, because let's say everybody belongs to some enforcement agency,
right.
And two enforcement agencies will bargain over the rules based on, all right, now, I'm an enforcement agency A,
right.
We have bargained for no capital punishment.
Between us.
So then I go kill somebody in C.
In that case, you have to know what the rules are between yours and C.
That's what I thought. So then you have to know the rules for every single enforcement agency and know who is associated with every enforcement agency. This seems to sort of stretch credibility in any notion of efficiency.
It would stretch credibility to assume you do it perfectly. But to begin with, there's going to be a good deal of pressure to uniformity for market reasons, that it's going to be easier to deal with people if many of the courts agree to similar rules. And second, we do in a certain sense have a real-world example of this. I don't know if you're familiar with the 18th century English system of private prosecution associations, but that was a system where 18th century England, as you probably know, but I don't know if everybody does, criminal prosecution was private. That is, on paper, it was the same system of criminal law and tort law as ours, but they didn't have public prosecutors or police in the 18th century except for actual offenses against the crown. So the question is, why does anybody ever bother to prosecute? And the answer is one of the answers is private deterrence. And it's easy to see if you're a repeat player, if you're in some business where you're continually at risk of theft, that when somebody steals from you, you'll go to a good deal of trouble to track him down and get him hanged, because then the next person won't. But you can correct my view of this as our other expert on this subject in a minute. But from the standpoint of the ordinary person who expects to be at risk of theft, you know, once every 3 years or something, he can't establish a reputation. So what you have are private agencies, which generally are specific to a single town, where a bunch of people chip in money to a fund that will be used to prosecute a felony against any member of the association. And the list of members of the association is published in the newspaper for the felons to read. So that at least was a case in which, you know, I'm sure it did not work perfectly, but it was a case in which if you are a felon, you want to take some care to know whether the person you're thinking of robbing is or is not a member of the local.
Okay, well, I can unsee that, but that seems to imply that there is an understanding of what a felony is apart from what's been negotiated by your enforcement agencies.
Well, in
that system, there was a presumption of what the law is, and the private agencies would drag the individual.
Yeah, private agencies are not making the law. My point is that was a system where in order to functioning in that system, the risk to you of acts with regard to different people depended on whether or not they were members of a private prosecution.
Right.
Just as in the system I'm describing, the risk to me of pirating your book is going to depend on whether your agency has an agreement with my agency defining property, defining copyright, or whether the agreement between our agencies specifies a court that doesn't believe in copyright. So in that, I'm saying my point is that it's an analogous case where to know the legal consequences of doing X to person Y, you have to know who Y associations.
So how does it work? All right. A and B have both agreed on copyright law. I'm in C. We haven't agreed.
Right.
So I pirate your cup.
You have some agreement. You have some other agreements with A and B, though, right? You've got to have an agreement with, say, I'm A and you're C.
Uh-huh.
So you C and A have an agreement that there isn't any copyright. right? Every pair of firms have agreed on a court, and every court has legal rules.
Every pair of firms has contracted over every issue.
They've contracted on a court that will settle issues between them, and that court has a set of rules, and you expect there will be many cases in which different pairs will use the same court. There are going to be some economies of scale to the court business, but the system that I originally set up when I originally wrote the book is one in which legal rules are pairwise defined. Every pair of enforcement agencies has agreed on a court, and in principle, every pair of agencies could have agreed on a different court. I don't think it's very likely outcome given their efficiencies to standardization. So that's right. Yeah.
Mark,
sorry. Yes, you want to correct me because you know a lot about this stuff too.
I thought we were speaking to the litigation stuff. What you said was fine. My question was about the similar to Karen's. Surely there's a huge tendency towards at least standardization of the law because of the network and economics you mentioned.
Yep.
So like the property rights commission, you can think of all kinds of other examples where it's just going to be too costly to have these bilateral. It's too costly to maintain different law. My laws to one person, I have to follow different laws with respect to one person than with respect to every other people because the laws are defined bilaterally. Surely there'll be the network that founders will make it inevitable that we have a single legal system in some sense.
So therefore state laws don't exist at present? We are in a polylegal system, even though we don't usually think about it that way.
There's a tendency towards scale, at least.
But, maybe, but...
And so but why can't you separate out the enforcement? The example you gave separates out enforcement from the rule.
That's right.
So why does the rule... Like you can have agreements on the... I think there'd be a strong tendency towards monopoly on the rule.
Of course. Well, as to begin with, I would argue that there are real efficiency advantages to having multiple sets of rules, that there will be different groups of people who actually are in different circumstances. If you think about the question of communities in areas where water is scarce, they probably want different sets of property rights with regard to the right to draw water from a river than people in places where the stuff just comes out of the sky the way it does here and falls on your head. And so it would seem to me that there are going to be some real efficiencies to having in some respects to having varying laws. And where there aren't any such efficiencies, now there's going to be a tendency towards standardization. Just as, you know, in our legal system, in a sense, the law is made by a private organization which does the more or less accepted official summaries of what tort law is. You know, the restatement of whatever the latest restatement of torts and such is. And they have no power to compel states, and states don't necessarily go along with what they're doing, but there's some mechanisms which encourage standardization. So I expect it would probably turn out that for certain parts of the law, there are one or two or three standard accounts of that law, and practically every arbitration agency signed up on those, whereas there would be some specialized parts of the law where you had an agency where one of its specialties was serving a certain market niche, and that market niche really required much more detailed legal rules for this issue. Those rules would be a nuisance for other people. And so I would expect you would get the sort of mixture of standardization and variation you usually get in the world.
One other thing I didn't understand was how do you guard against the notice argument that they're being, how do you prevent one of these agencies from just dominating the other?
But that ends up depending on whether or not there are large economies of scale in either of the two things it's doing. That's really where I started.
Mm-hmm.
That I don't see any, I mean, it's not logically impossible, and if so, the system's unstable.
I just have how to work this in. The examples you give about different states and different uses of water, which exists now, those are geographical entities, the states, that everybody living within that geographical entity obeys that law.
Yeah, that's doing inefficient arrangement because it's dangerous.
I mean, if I'm, you know, can I take the water out of the river upstream? Well, if you have many different rules within the same geographical location, I don't see how...
My point is that the present system is also inefficient because the state might easily... My point is the state might easily cover some areas where specialized water law was useful and somewhere it wasn't. And we don't know if it's got the efficient water law rules. But I would expect that there would indeed be some pressure to try to get the people living along a single river to the customers of agencies, all of which had contracts with each other specifying a water law. I don't assume that the distribution of customers is going to be random. I assume it'll be sort of semi-geographical. There will be some agencies that specialize in some areas, but what I really need for the system to work is that it's sufficiently dispersed so that as a practical matter, customers have alternatives.
Yeah, that's
what I've also been looking at in the Amish, because you've got the same, as some of you know, I've been researching the Amish the last few weeks for the book I'm doing on legal systems, very different. And they are very interesting because the Amish are a system of competing legal rules. In a sense, there's no enforcement because they don't use force at all. They're pacifists. But the highest legal level of the Amish system is a congregation, what they call a district, which has 30 to 40 households in it. That's where the legal rules determine. The legal rule of the congregation next door could be different. And there's a certain amount of standardization occurring through various mechanisms among them. But in fact, it is a competitive system of legal rules enforced by nonviolent methods.
Are people free to move back and forth among the congregation?
Well, first, you couldn't move unless the other congregation could accept you. In some areas, the congregations are territorial sovereigns. Typically, in an area where the congregations don't disagree very much, they are effectively territorial sovereigns, so you could move, you have to sell your farm and buy another farm. In areas where you have where you have a lot of congregations not in fellowship with each other, meaning that their ordinum, their set of rules is noticeably different, it is common for them to overlap so that you could, in fact, switch from a lower congregation to a higher congregation, defined in how strict their rules are, without moving at all, as long as the higher one was willing to accept you. So that basically, the only point at which there's a real restriction, this depends on the congregations, there are different rules, is if you have been, in effect, excommunicated and banned by your congregation, then if the congregations are following the rule called Strengmeidung, other ones aren't supposed to take you in, and nobody's supposed to associate with you until you've made peace with your home congregation. Whereas if you're under the weak Maidung rule, the assumption is that your home congregation will drop the ban once you have been accepted by some other Amish or Mennonite who are real closely related and have made it clear that you're sort of at peace with them and are functioning with them. So one of the interesting distinctions is that some of them have the strength and some of them the weak, I even kind of what the German is for the weak, Schwach maybe, version of it. Yeah.
So to understand, one of your key points is sort of trying to answer James Buchanan's objection where he said you got to have a baseline.
Right.
You essentially say there's going to be showing point baselines, most likely the pre-existing legal system of the sort of the state system.
That's one possible answer, yes, in this paper.
So I sort of
someone's read the paper.
Questions about that. One is, why wouldn't the baseline just be the state of nature where, I'm free to aggress against you, you're free to aggress against me, the only property rights or respect either ones you can secure by force or ones that, I voluntarily choose.
It's an interesting possibility.
Secondly, I do wonder whether it really would be a state-run system would be most likely baseline, given that if you think about sort of an anarchic system or a state-run system, sort of two possible scenarios seem to be most likely. One, historically common, the state-run system just breaks down due to crisis. The other one, there's sort of the popularity of anarchist or libertarian ideology increases enormously. And neither of those scenarios seem to bode well for people's respect for the pre-existing.
But you're leaving out the third, and I think the most plausible one, which is the one that you see, for example, in Snow Crash, if you've read that, which is where there is no point at which the government vanishes, it just becomes increasingly irrelevant. So if you imagine a continuous change in Snow Crash, and there are still some buildings that have federal employees in it, it's not doing anything. I mean, maybe they come to the office every day, but the actual stuff is being done elsewhere. So if you imagine...
How's that different than current?
Unfortunately, they are doing things now.
So,
the science fiction. It's a fairly popular science fiction novel.
So I think so long as land is an important asset and governments have territorial monopolies of forest or parks monopolies over land, that Snow Crash area, as fun a book as it is, I'm not sure it's actually nearly as likely as the other two.
Maybe. I agree that those are all possibilities, and you may be right. I can certainly, you could also imagine if it's, an anarchist, if it's libertarian ideas spreading, maybe everybody is a Randian or everybody is a Rothbardian, and they start from that as bargain from that. But I don't know. But it does seem to me that the that, to me at least, the most plausible thing is just that more and more things get done privately outside of the governmental system. Government has fewer resources, finds it harder to collect taxes. People are less willing to do things just because the government tells them to. And at some point, you've got de facto anarchy. People know perfectly well that if you call the police, you'll get a recording saying they'll get back to you next week. And so everybody is being protected by, people are protected by, you know, gated communities are, in a sense, a current version of this sort of thing. And so if you move to a point where practically everybody is sending their kids to private schools, using UPS instead of the post office, calling Brinks instead of the cops, you could then have a situation in which the government was sort of gradually fading out of realm. Now, I should mention one other. There's another scenario for anarchy which really is relevant, but which is sort of orthogonal to this, and this is crypto-anarchy. That is, you can imagine that what happens is governments continue to rule real space, but real space becomes less and less important in people's lives. And since there are fairly plausible, I think, scenarios for how you get anarcho-capitalism developing online due to the fact that if you can combine anonymity and reputation, which public key encryption lets you do, and if enough people are doing it, it's real hard to enforce laws against people you don't know who they are. And so therefore you can imagine a system where online private mechanisms simply take over because the government is ineffective. And if you ended up in a world where most of what mattered was online, and furthermore, where to the extent the governments were still there, they were much more competing with each other than they are now, because you could move from one geographical location to another at almost no cost because all of your friends are online anyway. And your job is online, and basically jobs don't matter very much. So I think you can imagine that is another scenario. And I'm not a prophet. I mean, I find it interesting to explore possible things that could happen. If any of you have read my Future Imperfect, I sort of did my best not to claim any of these is going to happen, but I'm going to say these are things that could happen. This is what it would look like if each of them happened, kind of thing.
I wonder if your argument against Nozick and say other things like Tyler or whatever, who have tried to stress this network externality and the idea of the pushing towards that, you know, is actually even stronger about your efficiency claims when you consider as long as the market is contestable. So, for example, with the rise of alternatives, like say, for example, the interaction between your real space and the, what did you just call it, crypto or whatever space, the fact that that exists actually puts more pressure back on the real space as well, which makes that market more core. So you could have a dominant firm, but as long as that dominant firm exists in a contested space, it has to behave much more like an efficient firm. And I'm wondering if that actually cuts in your paper against the idea that there might be why it is that there might not be as much a market failure as might look at if we look at it.
Are you talking about the cartel problem?
Yeah, like even any of these things, because the idea that as long as it's a contested space, you're always going to have that ability for someone to be the fly-by-night competitor to come in and then force you out, right? And so as long as you have that, the size of the thing doesn't matter. It's the contested contestation of the entry into the market, right?
And then the question is, how contestable is it really if somebody has got all the tanks?
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe it is, because maybe, again, if real space doesn't matter very much, in a sense, if you imagine a future where we're spending most of our time
lying. I can control the electric magnetic space waves, right?
No, what I'm thinking of is, what I'm imagining is a future where we spend our time in little cubicles being fed cheap, highly nutritious stuff from soybeans, but that's all right, because that's just our real space.
I prefer the current world.
That's just our real space, and our minds are in a rich virtual reality where everybody has an estate on the California coast, and everybody is beautiful and slim, and most of us really are slim, because, of course, since we can eat all the calories we like in virtual reality without getting fat, and our soybeans, our sushi, and Baskin-Robbins ice cream to us, because all of that is only stuff happening inside your head, right? So that you could imagine a future of that sort, and lots of people can ride your cubicles and, you know, ship your cubicles around if you want to do it. So
you'd embrace the vat and the electric.
The embrace is a real problem, and the interesting one is, I don't think Nozick's that. Nozick is the experience machine.
That's what I'm saying, but it's just, you know.
Except that notice that the critical point here, and I think I do discuss this actually in Future Imperfect, is some activities, it matters if they're real space and some it doesn't. So that from my standpoint, I don't care if you read my books in paper or on the screen, because what I want to do is to convey information, and that's a virtual reality, as it were, technology. I do care whether I really have children who love me and who are happy, bright, interesting people, or whether I only have the illusion of those children. So that the part of Nozick's experience machine that makes me unwilling to accept it is that what it's providing you is not an actual rich life, but only the illusion. But as far as I can see, large parts of what matter to us can really happen in virtual reality. You can have real friendships in virtual reality. You can really learn stuff. You can really teach stuff. I mean, this is an issue which I'm concerned with because all members of my family, myself included, spend some time in World of Warcraft. And should I be bothered by that? Should I think of that as not real? Well, is it any less real than playing bridge, which is what my sister and her husband do very seriously, or than, you know, playing tennis or something? What?
Dungeons and Dragons.
Yeah. But there's a sense in which I'm not sure how we decide among, insofar as what you're doing is avocation, is doing it for the fun, then I don't see any superiority to real space over virtual space. On the other hand, if you produce food in the World of Warcraft, it won't feed anybody. Whereas if you grow food in the real world, it will feed people. So I think you have to make that distinction, and I don't see a problem if the places where you're replacing real space with virtual reality are places where accomplishments in virtual reality are just as real as the compliments. Yeah. Compliments in real space, you just have to stick to those two.
You had a follow-up?
Yeah, okay. Just briefly. So I think, you put me on to that. What I was going to say is that it'd be great if I had my own personal law. So obviously I don't believe that marijuana is illegal, so it'd be great if I could, you know, have a legal system, subject to a legal system which is consistent with my beliefs as opposed to the one I actually have.
Sure. How much are you willing to pay for that?
Something, not that much. I don't like it anymore.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't really care that much anymore. But in any case, the point Ian Carroll raising is I think the number of bilateral agreements I would have to make in order for us all to have, you know, something close to our own personal law are just infeasible. So what would end up...
But it's infeasible anyway. That isn't the reason you can't do it. The reason you can't do it is that the rule between you and me is the same as the rule between me and you. So even if there were no transaction costs, it's still the case that if I believe that you shouldn't be allowed to smoke marijuana and you believe you should, there isn't any legal system which both of us get what we want. I mean, that's a constraint.
There are some other people who are willing to do my legal world. And so with respect to them, in any case, what I'm suggesting is that even, okay, maybe marijuana is a bad example, but a lot of the examples we can think about, they're going to be very high bargaining costs if we all...
Yeah.
But one way of sourcing that is self-effect. So if all the people who have libertarian views go to live in New Hampshire, then we can have a protection agency in New Hampshire which is, you know, consistent with those beliefs. So what you end up with is then what we have now, territorial legal systems, as opposed to personal legal systems.
How much of that happens is really going to depend on to what degree you have bunches of people who correlate in many things in what they desire. You have to not only be willing to have all of those things, you also have to be willing to put up with New Hampshire winters.
Yeah.
And you have to be willing to travel to visit your other friends and so forth. So that I could certainly imagine some geographical sorting occurring for some sets of people with some interests, as it does in the present system. I mean, there's a reason there are no Amish in Europe.
Yeah.
They're all in North America.
So unbundling is key to the story, I think. But that, it's not, now the state has bundled up legal protection, healthcare, all kinds of stuff. Whereas in the sanity scenario, you can just unbundling. So that's going to allow a finer matching.
And some of it will get geographical. You know, you'll have some areas where most of the people are customers of Agency A, and Agency A, in its bargaining with all other agencies, says, look, we aren't willing to pay very much for no marijuana law in Wyoming. Maybe we cheat their action. However, it matters a whole lot to us that your customers not claim that they can stop our people in New Hampshire from smoking. And since it matters a lot to us and very little to your people, because why do they care if all those New Hampshire stoners are, they're not going to run into me because I'm in Wyoming, then I think that you're likely to get an equilibrium of that sort.
Yeah, I'll come back.
I think there is a simple solution to this bargaining cost problem and the knowledge problem. If we take the present laws and we're saying let these present laws be just default rules. So if you don't know anybody, then by default these are the rules.
When you say we are saying, who is enforcing this?
No, let's say there is the situation that we are into now, and there's a small change, namely that all the laws are redefined as default rules, which means that if you find some other people who don't like the default rules, you can make a club there with different rules, and those are the rules in the club. But with people in the club, with all the other people, you're interacting based on the rules that there are, on the laws. So that would give you all the freedom of exit without all these bargaining problems. Okay, so you don't have to have many, many clubs who have bargained with each other. You just have the system that we're having now, but with the exit clause.
Except you can't really exit, because you and your club agree that you can smoke marijuana, but Pete isn't a member of your club, and he's going to call the cops when he hears that you're smoking marijuana.
Well, the idea is that you're not smoking marijuana with him.
But unless the default rule says people can only complain if you do it in their presence, then he can still get you arrested.
Yeah, the idea is that you have these rules that are bilateral. Okay, just like you were presenting the story. So the rule between me and Pete is a bilateral rule. So if he doesn't agree with smoking marijuana, I'm not going to smoke marijuana in his presence.
But he doesn't agree with your smoking it out of his presence either.
Yes, but that's not a bilateral rule.
I don't understand what that means. How you could imagine that the original default rule says that smoking marijuana
is illegal
in the presence of somebody who will complain. But unless it says that, then you're still under his authority if he hasn't agreed to your rule.
The rule says it's illegal to smoke marijuana.
Yes.
But there is like a constitutional rule that says that all rules are just default rules. So you can make a club. So within that club, you could have different rules.
Well, we say a default rule. Default rule means... Are you saying that you get to change his rights when you join your club?
He's right.
Under the default rule, he is allowed to have you arrested for smoking marijuana. How does that change when he hasn't joined your club?
That's allowed because there isn't this stipulation that the rules are default rules. The rules are not default rules because you're enforcing them on everybody regardless of whether they're agreeing with it.
But then I don't understand what you are proposing. Is what you mean by a default rule a rule that only applies to you if you agree to it?
No, it means that you can create a club with different rules than the default rules.
But the question is, are those different rules only with regard to people in the club,
or
do they apply? But then they don't apply to the legal rights for the people outside the club and inside the club, and he has a legal right to have you arrested for smoking marijuana. That was the default rule.
Yeah, the default rule will press on the club rule.
Someone in the club can't prosecute.
That's right.
But someone outside the club can.
Yeah, but the idea is to redefine these laws as bilateral agreements. So if you have people outside the club with someone inside the club, you can't have like a right to arrest you for doing something, inside the club, because inside the club, by this stipulation, there are different rules.
So I have a one-person club, and the rules of my one-person club differ from the ordinary rules in only one way, and that is that I am allowed to kill anybody named Peter. under that rule, I shouldn't have made this bigger suggestion at this point, but I'm a brave person, and I'm even armed. I've got a pocket knife, so I'll defend myself. So I make that rule, and as you've described it,
that's not true. So that's a rule that is between you and people named Pete. Okay, so people named Peach should agree to that.
No, no, but your right to smoke marijuana when Peter doesn't want you to is also a rule between you and Peach, so how can you change it without his consent?
So you can't change it without his consent.
So since you can't change it without his consent, he can still have you arrested when you smoke marijuana?
Yes.
Well, maybe you have to think about it this way. Like, we're not allowed, our natural law has laws against discrimination, but yet I could form a club which is, you know, males-only club, like Augusta National, right? You know, and so what happens? Every year, there's a huge outcry of people trying to challenge that rule, but it's still held up. Is that what you kind of mean?
Yeah.
Well, I thought what you meant was, all right, how do we get from here to there? It's more of a transition problem. And if we just stipulate that the laws exist now, but if you form a club, you can change those laws as long as you just interact with those people.
Yeah.
But now his point is clearly that people outside the club may not...
Don't like what's going on in that club.
You know, and that leads me to the issue that I was kind of worried about, and that is maybe underplaying the potential for force in this, because there are some really emotional issues that people get, you know, really exercised about. I mean, think not drugs, abortion, you know, they're willing to go to the mattresses for that.
But I think the number of people who are really willing to go to the mattress for those things is much smaller than it would be. That's right, and if they had to be across. Not that there are none. I mean, I'm sure there, you know, there are people who, you know, assassinate abortion doctors and things. But that represents a tiny, tiny fraction of a population of 300 million people.
Uh-huh.
And they're not going to have very much market power when, you know, 1,000 people say, well, I really don't like abortion, but as long as you're willing to agree that members of our protected agency aren't allowed to have abortions, and I will associate with other people who are members of that or of agencies in fellowship with that.
I don't know. That's an empirical question.
Well, but how much do people?
Think of child pornography exploiting minors. I mean, I think that you would get much more widespread.
Maybe we haven't invaded Thailand yet. That is to say, the U.S. is willing to go as far as the, it seems to me, rather extraordinary policy of saying that we will prosecute U.S. citizens who do things we disapprove of outside the U.S. in the child, not really pornography, but child sex context. But we are not willing to go to the extent of saying to Thailand, you've got to impose our rules or we will start bombing
you. Don't you think that's because we consider them totally other? They're not part of our society?
No.
If I'm living in this society, and if people who are very different from me have peculiar rules, I may deplore them, but I don't feel an emotional connection to them that I do with people living next door, the guy living next door who may bring underage kids into it.
If you feel strongly enough about it, you may end up, in effect, self-segregating with people who share your views and then thinking of other people as outsiders. That is, to some extent, you can decide who counts as your people, and people do that. The Amish are doing that, and have been doing it for, you know, something over 100 years, but their view is that we're outsiders. I mean, we're people. They believe that we have rights, and they aren't supposed to violate our rights, but they aren't upset over the fact that we are doing the things that their rules say we ought not to do. Agreed. Yeah, sure.
No one else is there. Because I'm just going to parrot what John Nyberg thinks. It's funny, I was talking about this with him recently. He thinks that people have property rights. People have strong preferences over lifestyles, just to Karen's point. And let's say one of his explanations for why there's so much persistent poverty in countries like the Philippines or other developing countries is that actually, we're also discussing this in the cards in Vigua, elites in countries like the Philippines really like being at the top of, they really like the lifestyle they have, where they're the elites in their countries, and they're actually willing to pay a lot of money to keep being on top of this, to have the lifestyle they want to have. And if you have rapid economic growth in a country like the Philippines, you could compensate these people with a lot of money, and everyone would be better off. But they seem to prefer being at the top of a small train, as opposed to being just anybody in a big train.
big fish in a small pond.
Exactly, big fish in small ponds. My metaphor didn't work. So you can think similarly in the case, in the Amity case, that people may really not want to live in a society where people smoke drugs or people live certain lifestyles. I may be willing to pay a lot to stop that.
Maybe,
and hire...
How much more?
Which will attack people who do it.
How much more are you willing to pay to do that than to simply say, "Well, our gated community consists of virtuous people, and everybody in there. One of the conditions of coming to the community is you agree not to smoke marijuana, and we'll sort of look down on the people outside of that, some of whom do, because after all, the people who want to smoke marijuana are willing to pay quite a lot to their agencies." To protect their right to do so. It just seems to me, not that it's logically impossible, I made this point back in Machinery, that you could imagine in a society with strong enough prejudice against heroin that even in my system you would have, in effect, laws against heroin. But it seems to me that as a general rule, people are willing to pay less to restrict other people's freedom than those other people are willing to pay to keep their freedom, and that therefore you would tend not to get that equilibrium. Not that it's a logical impossibility, yeah.
So related to that, I think there's a difference between sort of things where you have a preference if it has some kind of direct or physical impact on you, like the condominiums that used to ban cats and dogs, not because the members thought that owning cats and dogs is inherently evil and should be banned for time, just they didn't themselves want to be inconvenienced by the cats and dogs, versus, say, like my attitude towards slavery, which is not primarily about that if I saw a slave or if there was a slave living near me, it would be inconvenient, like I would be against it, and am against it even when slavery exists thousands of miles away in North Korea and it has very little, you know, tangible impact on me. I think it's that second scenario where it can't as easily be dealt with.
Maybe, but I guess my question would be, assuming you believe that slavery does exist in the world at the moment,
it
probably exists in a noticeable number of different places, in different forms, how much trouble have you gone to try to find the place where expenditures by you would have the most effect in reducing slavery? Maybe it's in the Sudan, maybe it's North Korea.
In my case, I have gone through some trouble, albeit only to find out that my expenditures would probably be ineffective.
For North Korea, they would be. Have you looked at other places in the world?
A little bit. I don't want to get into
yep.
to take up time,
sure.
But there are these organizations that actually buy up the freedom of slaves. My concern about them is that they encourage other people to seize new slaves.
That's
it's
a
like
problem.
The sort of hostage exchange and the like. So I think that's
yep.
a difficult trade-off. But if I had vastly more resources than I actually do, then I would perhaps do things like, you know, fund military forces to get rid of these areas or that have slavery and so forth. And sort of my attitude towards slavery may be replicated by some other people's attitudes
yeah.
towards drug use, abortion, et cetera.
One presumably could get some evidence from the 19th century anti-slavery society.
Where the British government did use force to suppress slavery in places where...
Yeah, I was thinking less of the government and of the private actors and the question of how large the resources were they were willing to devote to that. And I don't know. My guess would have been less than the slave owners were willing to devote to keeping their slaves. But
yes, but ultimately they persuaded enough governments to change
yep.
their policies.
Yep.
Yeah, there was compensation policy, though, right?
Depends
given
where.
Given the present value.
Depends where.
The slave owners were compensated. Others
no, England, the court found that you couldn't have slavery in England. That was a court decision. It was the slaves outside of England under
outside
this rule
yeah, right.
In the West Indies where they compensated.
Yeah. So with slavery, we think it's just fine that we had that change,
yeah.
even though governments did it. But
yeah.
there might be other issues which
were less
problematic for your framework
yeah.
in that regard.
Martha?
I wanted to ask you, how is conflict resolved? So the system seems to operate smoothly as long as the situations that people run into are predicted by the rules, so the rules are established at random, yes. But being an Austrian economist, yes, there is this uncertainty, people can be surprised, you have entrepreneurial invasion, yes, like intervention, whatever, that can change the system, yes, and then people face situations that they don't have regulations for, and so what happens?
But the way, at least I imagine it, is that what our agencies are contracted to is not regulations, but a court.
Mm-hmm.
The court has a set of legal rules. presumably the court has some mechanism for deciding new cases. And so since we are committed to that particular court, when the case none of us have thought about appears, we say, well, send it to the court, and the court will do something, and maybe it's not what we expect. But so the harder problem, it seems to me, would be what happens if it hasn't occurred to you that there might be cases involving three parties instead of two parties. And there, I don't know, but I suppose the real answer, or what about the case that it hasn't occurred to you that there might be a dispute between you and me, and at the point when we send that dispute to the court that our agency agreed on, we discover that that court went bankrupt last week and no longer exists. And in that case, I think the answer is that our agencies have to negotiate de novo, but it's much easier if you can pre-agree, because this new case is going to be one in which maybe the agencies each know what kind of verdict they want. But nonetheless, they would like to be at peace with each other, and so you would think that they would have an incentive to then say, all right, let us find another court that will decide this for us, and maybe we'll pick one where we're not sure what its verdict will be, so that we're neither of us is giving in to the other, as it were. So I don't see why you couldn't in this system deal with new issues in that kind of a way.
It seems to me that a lot of some of the objections are kind of red herrings, right? Which is, you already got a choice of law in some of the contracts. It's just like this, right? If you want to talk about abortion, through most of American history, states had completely different abortion rules, and people perfectly coexisted with that, right? We could have abortion regulated on the county level, and people would, you know, be perfectly fine with that, I suspect. So I think a lot of these are sort of fictional externalities that people aren't really willing to paid for, except for, you know, granting slavery, but slavery is to some extent, I think, too generous compared to most of the issues that arise. But it seems to me that this is the, so most of these issues, I think, are not that significant, but it's a stranger interaction issue that seems to be the motivating argument for the rise of sort of geographical monopolies on force is stranger interactions. What I hear you saying is, and I think first, stranger interactions are quite overstated because people may have the same insurance company, or you may be covered by a credit card agreement, or there's all kinds of things that turn stranger interactions into others. But it sounds like what you're saying is you think that even with respect to stranger interactions, it might arise for the first time because of the reputational dealing between whoever people's parties are. They'll have an incentive to basically choose an ex-ante efficient rule rather than just allow forum shopping.
But it also doesn't matter very much whether it's ex-ante efficient, it only comes up once. Or, you know, once they see it as a likely future possibility, they have an incentive to try to bargain towards the efficient rule. I mean, if they haven't done the bargaining in advance, then I think it's more a matter of just finding some rule. But no, I think the point with regard to what you're right now, of course, the abortion case is a little complicated, so I think through most of the 19th century, it wasn't recognized that a first trimester abortion was an abortion at all. This was a procedure to recommence the menstrual cycle. But I think it's true that people tend to be much more concerned about those close to them in some sense. So that this has sort of been part of my argument with Bob Frank on his argument, where he says that libertarians ought to approve of redistributional government activity because, after all, rich people get a benefit in status from the kisses of poor people get a cost in status from the kisses of rich people, so this is just a fair compensation. And my main response to that is that Bob Frank has already shown us how in firms, the wages firms pay will already compensate for those external status effects in market equilibrium, and that was what was neat about his original book. And as long as most of the effects are short-range effects, people you're associating with, it's not like, you know, insofar as the person who's making $1 million a year cares about status and status compared to the person who's making $800,000 a year, not status compared to the people who are off in the inner city, you know.
I once asked Bob Frank whether we should have a status tax on all Ivy League professors. I think that was not an appropriate status tax.
I have, I think, a but he would, I mean, in principle, he would say yes in the sense that he would like them to pay a high income and such. No, the question that I tried to push him on and was never able to get him to answer is, since he was claiming that going to good universities and maybe even good suburban high schools was mainly producing status rather than that was he in favor of abolishing all subsidies to higher schooling and replacing them with tax? And similarly for the, and I put that question to him several times when we were arguing on my blog, and he never answered it. But,
Lloyd? Yeah, just sort of a follow-up, I guess, with, on a couple of these points. What could appear as stability with regard to rules, let's say with regard to abortion, may just reflect the inframarginality that most of us are with regard to changing the outcome. That is, it's not a case that you don't care. Certainly, you might not care about what happens far away, but you might care a great deal. But as in response to your question to Ilya, if we feel we have no